Full Service Radio is proudly supported and hosted by Simplecast, the easiest way for a podcast creator to publish and distribute audio on the internet. For more information, visit simplecast.com. Full Service
Radio. This is J.J. Burden, New York City. The responsibility of putting together this material is fully mine. I did it as honestly as I could.
And that was the Freddie Red Quartet you heard just a little bit of, with Jackie McLean on saxophone, with the song Who Killed Cock Robin from Shirley Clark's 1961 dope masterpiece, The Connection. Censored by licensing boards across the U.S., the film never became much of a hit, which means it's perfect for a place like Sun Cinema. Good morning, guys.
Hey, Jason. Good morning. That's good. That's good intro of that song. Oh. I know David's sick of it because we've been playing that trailer.
That trailer's played a lot. I've been quite a bit the last couple of weeks, and I have seen that trailer so much.
We're really pushing this movie.
I know that song by heart. I could probably just start humming it.
Well, hey, good day to you guys.
Yeah. We're here at the Sun Cinema Podcast from Full Service Radio at the Line Hotel. You've probably been here for drinks, maybe, right? That's what everyone comes here for?
Yeah.
A great cocktail list. The food's pretty amazing. It's on point.
And we're here to talk about the specifics of the food of the line. And
changing it up a bit.
Yeah, well, that movie, The Connection, I know I've been talking about it like every second I get to on the podcast and also everywhere else, and still we're only half sold on the damn movie.
Oh, really?
Yeah, no, I think people are smart.
I think people are smart, and it's such an unusual film, that's been so rarely seen. So it's one of those things you definitely want to check it out in person if you can, I mean, you can't find it anywhere, really, can you?
No. It's maybe Filmstruck has it.
Maybe.
So if you have Filmstruck,
I don't think it's on there.
Okay. Yeah, screw that. You can't find it anywhere. Only we have it. We're going to try to attempt to recreate how it premiered in the U.S., and we're going to try to have the police shut us down right. And arrest us, happened to the projectionist the first time they screened it in New York.
Excellent.
How was last week, David? What did we see?
Last week was great. What did we see? So we showed the Chisholm Doc. Jason was there for that.
Yeah.
As a documentary, it was okay. I thought.
That's the thing. As a documentary, it's okay, but it's one of those
things. The content was great.
Yeah, Shirley Chisholm is if you don't know, she was the first female, and a black female at that, to run truly a real race for president.
In 72,
yeah. No less.
It's pretty cool.
It was one of those things where maybe the documentary wasn't the greatest thing ever, but the content's so strong.
Yeah.
And the information that you didn't have before you watched that documentary is so massive that it actually makes for, an enjoyable time, because it's everything, at least for me, not being a political historian at all, it was all pretty new information.
Yeah.
And just to see how that race came together and kind of how she didn't get a lot of support.
They gave her a fair shake, right?
I mean, she gave herself a fair shake. That was what was cool about it. She just wouldn't back down. And she just kept coming, and she would show up, and they would try to... There was a piece on... It was like a 60 Minutes type of show in 72, and they didn't invite her on, and she, it was like, oh, bull crap, I'm running. And, they had to, the next week, then give her time.
Yeah.
Tricky DNC.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it was just, the whole thing was really interesting. It was a great film, but that was one.
Yeah, yeah. And then on Wednesday, we did Mary Jane Rigolato presented The Girls. I didn't see that, but I did have a conversation with this guy who left halfway through it because he said it was the opposite of misogynist, which I just...
That's
thought was
success,
hilarious.
Right?
I was like, well, one is institutionalized, one is not.
Did you refund him?
No. Thursday
this movie wasn't misogynist enough. Can I get
a refund?
Thursday.
Poor guy. Thursday, Scum Club presented American Psycho. Jason was there for that as well.
I was there for that. I was there with a good friend of the podcast and a great friend of Sun Cinema, Chris Chen.
Who fell asleep before the movie started.
Classic. Yeah. You got to have a dozing podcast.
We were like sold out. I was like, Chris, I don't know if I'm going to have a seat for you. He's like, yeah. And he goes, he sits down, falls asleep. But
before it even started.
For people who don't know Chris Chen,
he is a sleeper.
This guy, I think there was truly a Facebook page set up for him at one point in time where it was just places Chris Chen fell asleep.
Oh, I wanted pretty much to do anywhere. This blog so bad. We've all got pics of it.
Yeah, everyone's got photographs of Chris Chen falling asleep. And Dave and I were talking at the bar. It's like 7:45, like 15 minutes before the movie. I looked over and I pointed at Chris Chen. I'm like, look at this. Chris Chen's sound asleep.
No, but already. He's an Uber man. He only sleeps for like 20 minutes at a time.
Yeah. Da Vinci did that, right? It was like 20-minute naps. Yeah.
Da Vinci,
he takes all the 10, 20-minute naps a day.
He probably actually listens to this because he's a nice enough guy to do it.
Well, shout out to Chris Chen if you are listening. Yeah. It was a classic Chris Chen moment and a classic classic American kind of wild, dark, dark movie in American Psycho.
Yeah, how was the mood after American Psycho? Like, right after, how'd everyone feel?
That's a good question.
Classy?
Classy, yeah.
Yeah.
Murderous? I don't know.
I was disturbed.
And I was definitely disturbed also.
Yeah, I'm always disturbed by that movie, and I forget, and I go back to it like every 5 or 6 years. It's probably the third time I've seen it. I saw it when it came out, saw it maybe 5, 6 years later. So, you know, so here we are again seeing it. And I was kind of pumped. I was like, oh, yeah, I remember, you know, certain scenes, and this is going to be so much fun. And the soundtrack's great,
which we'll get to
in a little while. But it was one of those things where at the end of it, you're like, oh, I forgot how dark this is. You know, just mood setting dark.
Yeah. So it was funny. I was talking to Danielle after and Ben, her boyfriend. Danielle Vu is the one who runs this Scum Club. And they were talking about how Ben's dad was in town and how Danielle's like, oh, you should get him to come to see this movie. And his dad's really conservative. And he's just like, yeah, no, that's probably not going to fly. But I was thinking, I was like, you should just tell him, like, hey, this is the guy that you voted for.
Yeah, totally.
So, you know. Yeah, that's what I kept kind of thinking about during that movie, was just like, this is our president.
Well, it's been
the culture.
It's been a minute, but I remember the first time I watched it, wondering if the ending, is it supposed to be like this? Did it really happen? Is it psychological?
Oh, there was a lot of discussion.
You know, so it didn't really happen, or are rich psychos just so inside a little club that they'll just pretend anything happened and pretend anything didn't? And that clearly must be the reality. Because Because it's kind of just like, they kind of just like, hey, you're good, dude.
Pretend nothing
happened.
No, he's sitting there like freaking out. He goes up to his lawyer who he'd called the night before and is like panicked and won't leave him alone. And the guy's like, no, it's all right. You know, just basically go back to your seat and have your drink and enjoy your evening.
<It's> so like, dark.
Enjoy your day.
Yeah.
Cool.
What was the...
Persepolis is good.
It's an animated...
Is it? I don't know. Is that a joke? I thought it was Persepolis.
No. Okay.
I think it's Persepolis. That's how I've always said it.
I'm hoping you guys are wrong, and I'm going to look into this later. But
I've said it that way.
I'm going to hold back. I hope you're all wrong. $3. We're all throwing $3 into this pool.
Good animated Persian film. It's about a girl in Iran, and it's kind of dark, but good. Based on a comic.
Yeah, or a graphic novel.
Graphic novel.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do we want to hear the YouTube pronunciation?
Yes.
Yeah.
Here it comes.
Thank you. God.
Let's see.
Persepolis.
Hey.
Oh.
I'm going to... Okay. I've heard Iranian friends pronounce it differently, but I'm going to leave out of it.
Okay.
This is the English pronunciation. Okay. You know?
Then we showed A Girl Walks Home Alone at Night. Is there another way to pronounce that?
That was filmed in L.A.
That's true. It was.
So A Girl Walks Home Alone at Night.
A Girl Watches Home Alone at Night. another Iranian.
For that.
Great.
It was St. Patrick's Day.
It was St. Patrick's Day, and I think the people that came out for that obviously did not give a shit about St. Patrick's Day. No one wore green. There was no pinching.
Green Guinness.
I don't even know if we sold any Guinness, to be honest. Anyways, I love that movie. It's definitely one of my favorites, and it dawned on me about halfway through that two or three of my favorite movies are about female vampires. So that one, Let the Right One In, Only Lovers.
Oh, yeah. Wow.
And I don't know what that means. So I'm still
trying. Yeah, you should maybe talk to somebody.
I want to talk to someone.
Definitely have a type.
Have a type, yeah. Murderous. Sunday was Jean Dillman. I'm not going to go through the whole name. It's a Chantal Ackerman film. It's 3.5 hours long. It's basically a movie about a woman who's cooking.
Uh-huh.
She prostitutes to make money to provide sustenance for her son. Her husband has died. And it's just a lot of scenes of her cooking.
A lot of table scenes.
A lot of table scenes.
Prepping,
yeah.
Right? Like,
and it's funny because the Wikipedia description of it is real short, and it's just like basically what I just told you.
Right.
And then until on day three, she drops a clean spoon and overcooks the potatoes. And on at the end of day three, she murders her client, and then the movie ends. And you're like, oh, okay.
How?
It's a spoiler.
Let me ask you, like,
how many people stayed?
How many people were there? How many people stayed? And what was the mood and conversation like after that?
There wasn't much conversation after because it was 3.5 hours long.
That's
I think
a
most
slow.
People left. Yeah. There were. It was funny. There were 4 people at the beginning who said, "I don't know if I'm going to make it." And 2 of those were older ladies, and they left before intermission, which was, you know, 1 hour and 35 minutes in.
Right.
The mood. I don't know. There was a friend of mine was there who called this movie a thriller.
And, all right.
And shockingly, even though it is 3.5 hours long, it does engage you. It does, like, okay. It's kind of trance-like, hypnotic. You know, like, it keeps showing the same scenes over and over again where she leaves the house, she comes back, and there's this hallway, and you see the elevator. And you just start to feel comfortable with this hallway where you're like, I've been in this hallway before.
Right.
It starts to replicate real life, the sort of mundaneness and the repetition.
That sounds very David Lynchian in a way, just yeah. Like the repeating of a setting you in a place,
yeah.
You know, over and over again.
It was very meditative. I slept very well.
Sounds yeah. Very night. Empire Warhol.
Right. Yeah. Oh no, yeah. That's a good one too. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's the long and the short of last week.
Oh, yeah. No, it sounds like a good week.
That was the longest part of
yeah,
it.
Yeah. That's the longest part of the long week. I got to see a talk with filmmaker Michael Moore last night.
Oh, nice.
Kind of.
Yeah.
It was like
a
Facebook event at the Capitol building,
which was,
I thought for certain they were not going to let me in. I was all like trashing my weed on the lawn, like literally like, shit, it's in the Congressional Auditorium. It was cool. It was Elizabeth Warren, also in some films, hit actress from Sicko.
Sicko, yeah.
Michael Moore's movies.
Yeah.
And Bernie was there. And Derek Hamilton from...
Was Bernie Sanders part of the conversation as well? Or
yeah, he kind of just moderated guests, and they talked about wealth inequality. It was pretty cool. You know, Michael Moore had like fiery moments, and you're like, oh, I could see why he's like such a populist figure, why he makes like compelling movies
right.
That attract a lot of people. But also he would kind of meander all the time, and like if he started getting a reaction from the crowd, he just wouldn't stop.
Right.
And it would just like kind of dry out. So, and it's kind of like his recent work, which I haven't seen, you know? Sorry. I wanted to get him on the show, and I was like, I have no idea how we could do that. So since we didn't even try, I'm going to kind of poke jabs at him. What do we got next week?
Yeah, what's coming up?
Yeah, tonight is Out in the Night, is a documentary about 4 lesbian women in New York, black women who are being harassed. They fight the man back. They get charged as a gang.
I will tell you that trailer for that too, just having watched it a few times in the last week or so, it's like, whew,
yeah,
this is going to be
a fun one.
It's going to be tough.
Yeah.
And then Mary Jane again tomorrow.
Yeah, doing Wanda, Barbara Loden film.
We get the heroin jazz connection on Thursday.
Thursday. All right.
35 Shots of Rum.
35 Shots of Rum, I don't know a lot about. It's Claire Denis is the director.
Mm-hmm.
So that'll be fun.
We'll be doing a lot of rum. things, does, shots.
Does, I feel like all of her movies are like part of it's in Africa. Is part of this one in Africa? We'll find out on Friday.
Yeah.
Let's take a break. On. Yeah, let's. Well, we got later this week, Wes Anderson's Isle of Dogs is coming out,
which is
guaranteed to have a very twee and still pretty catchy soundtrack. Totally. So let's take a break. Let's come back and talk about soundtracks, how they engage us, and what the hell happens.
Yeah.
Sounds good.
In 87, Huey released this. Four, their most accomplished album. I think their undisputed masterpiece is Hip to Be Square. A song so catchy, most people probably don't listen to the lyrics. But they should, because it's not just about the pleasures of conformity and the importance of trends. It's also a personal statement about the band itself. Hey, Paul!
Oh man, a lot nicer to just listen to that and not watch it.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. How are the visuals on that?
It's great. It's really relaxing.
And that Jared Leto, right?
Isn't yeah, it's
future Jared Oscar Leto. Winner.
Yeah. Along with Christian Bale, future Oscar winner.
All right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And one ends up playing the Joker, one ends up playing Batman. It's all connected.
Holy crap, I hadn't Whoa. Thought about that.
Whoa. So when I was watching The Connection, I really liked the idea that there's a jazz band kind of waiting for their guy to show up, and they're kind of playing throughout the movie. They'll start taking up instruments, and that always reminded me of like Birdman, where you see Antonio Sanchez playing drums in the background. Yeah, that's cool. And then we started riffing on soundtracks, and I was trying to think of soundtracks that maybe interact with the audience and the actors at the same time. Maybe where they're hearing what we're hearing.
One of the things I was thinking about with The Connection that makes it really interesting, it just like preceded by 3 years, A Hard Day's Night with the Beatles, which was kind of the first... not the first, but certainly one of the first things that got a band and a movie and said, "Hey, we're gonna make a real movie here. It's gonna be 90 minutes long, but you guys are gonna play some instruments. We're gonna have some music overlay and things like that." But the idea that The Connection was doing that 3 years prior, in a very similar way, from what it looks like. Just from what I know of The Connection.
Yeah, well, I mean, definitely you would see it in mediums like literature, if you think of beat poetry or anyone, they're definitely describing, kind of trying to get you inside of what's going on musically in an environment, and then movies obviously have a chance to do that a lot better. But I imagine that like a lot of early films have these elaborate scores or originally were silent, just had organ music.
Right.
So... The Connection, 1961, you're really seeing like a really interesting way of tying that in throughout the movie and feeling especially interactive in it, which, we just saw with American Psycho, that's especially interactive, killing someone while describing Huey Lewis. Do the Right Thing, Radio Raheem.
Totally.
Was the one that came up.
Oh, for sure, yeah. Guardians of the Galaxy, the mixtape.
Well, yeah, that's gotten to such a point of them using it. It's like now I think they call the movies Volume 1, Volume 2. They're kind of playing up that they've got this mixtape that we all listen to watching it. Stranger Than Paradise is kind of my favorite Jim Jarmusch. How she's carrying around the boombox listening to Screaming Jay Hawkins all the time. Yeah.
So I guess what we're talking about here are interactions within the film where the music's truly a character being consumed by the actors and characters in the film.
Yeah, like soundtracks are great. Star Wars has a great John Williams score, but I don't think they're listening to
Lando Calrissian's not hearing that as he's walking around.
Or have I been watching it wrong?
No, I think...
Yeah, so things like Pulp Fiction, where you got Jackrabbit Slim's twist contest, and then the song lights up, and we're kind of all engaging with that same thing.
The Statler Brothers, he's listening to it on the radio, the flowers on the wall.
I mean, I know it happens like all the damn time in movies. As we were riffing on these, we're like, oh yeah, it's almost every movie has like some part. But some use it differently than others.
I think there's some that just do a really good job of like music is going to be part of this story.
Uh-huh.
You know, not just part of the experience for the audience sitting in the dark room, but part of the story and the characters are going to interact with this music as well.
Yeah, Baby Driver last year.
Baby Driver kind of took that to a new... I would argue sometimes it really worked and sometimes it was just kind of... it got kitschy. a little bit kitschy, a little bit repetitive to me, but there was definitely, you know, those early scenes where he's got the earbuds in and walking around and you're just like, oh yeah.
Man, oh yeah.
This is like... This is something I haven't quite seen it done this way before.
Yeah.
Where everything's syncing up to the music that this character's listening to, not music we're getting played over.
I liked how that one was foreshadowed with like him being the sound mixologist.
Oh, right, right, of course.
And then I'm glad they just like made a nice throwaway joke out of his like sound mixing, personally.
No, absolutely.
Can I play my least favorite? I told you guys about this off the show the other week. This is a clip from Vanilla Sky. I'll just let it speak
play
for
some
itself.
Radiohead.
This is Tom Cruise and Jason Lee driving around.
Barcelona, Looper,
Radiohead.
Look out!
Is it true Tom York did all his own stunts for that movie?
Just like the most painful name drop ever.
Radiohead.
Well, Dirty Dancing. Okay, Dirty Dancing is a great example of, you know, they're playing Love Man by Otis Redding.
Right.
Carrying the watermelon, just ripping dance party. You feel like you're there. You're sweating yourself. Except when it gets to the 80s music, I don't know. Am I supposed to think that they're also hearing the 80s music that
I don't think so. It surely doesn't sync up, you know, in a time universe.
Is Dirty Dancing more of a sci-fi movie than we were able to recognize?
Well,
have you seen Dirty Dancing on weed?
Have you had the time of your life? Yeah, I think that's interesting when films do that, when they drop out of sequence of kind of where they are in the space-time continuum as far as the movie's concerned and just drop in some big... There was... the Mary J. Blige song, which was nominated for...
Mudbound?
Yeah, Mudbound was nominated for Best Song this year at the Oscars. A lot of people had issues with that because it was everything, all the music, apparently, I apologize, I haven't seen the film, but there's, you know, the music is of the time and place all the way through the film until... Her last song, which is, you know, it is kind of an outro.
Just takes you out of the movie.
But that was the biggest problem people had. It was like, hey, I've been living in this world for 2 hours, and the last 4 minutes, you're going to take me completely out of it with this modern kind of song.
Yeah, well, imagine like, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? And then halfway through, there's like a montage with Skrillex or Johnny Appleseed or something.
Right.
Oh, or... fucking Sofia Coppola's Marie Antoinette when like there's the I Want Candy montage.
But that's like aware of it and messing with you. You know, at least it's maybe compelling you to have that.
It's at least coming at you with a wink.
Right.
And not trying to be serious and continue on with this, you know, cinematic Fair experience.
Well, I remember Seabiscuit, I think. I didn't see it. Randy Newman did the score. I remember Randy Newman did the score of that, and then because my friend was a big Randy Newman head, watched a movie. He's like, you know, he walked out of the movie being like, "There's one part where I just know it's not Randy Newman. I just know it wasn't him." And it turned out he like looked it up, and like Moby was like one of the songs for Seabiscuit. I didn't see Seabiscuit, but I imagine that takes you out of the environment. Like Randy Newman, sure. I imagine horse races to Randy Newman music.
I've seen Seabiscuit, but I feel like I must not have had much of a reaction all the way through.
Well,
didn't quite take me.
Oh, the club scene. World.
The club scene. The Moby club scene.
In Seabiscuit.
Yeah, part with Moby and Gwen Stefani do the duet. Well,
what's your Jack? Do you have like a favorite soundtrack? I mean, is there something, you know, that you go by? Is there a Saturday Night Live or Saturday Night Fever kind of soundtrack that you look at and go, okay, that was just extremely well
this
done.
This is totally random, but I guess I remember it from being younger. The Spawn soundtrack was like really formative for me. It's very random, but
now I want to.
That was a good one.
Yeah,
yeah. Now I gotta go back.
I've watched that movie a bit, but I don't remember the soundtrack.
Like weird trip hop and electronic stuff.
That's cool.
Back then, yeah, it was cool. Yeah. I think of like a really good, movie. The Black Panther soundtrack was very good, actually.
Definitely.
Yeah,
that was, and I thought that they implemented the kind of like pop song in the movie pretty well. I think it rolls at the credits, you know.
Yeah,
like, that's a good place for it. And
yeah, and with the previous ones that kind of tie into that sound that Kendrick also worked on, it's not so abrupt.
It's cohesive. As yeah,
yeah. Right. With the other ones, it really makes sense. When I heard the songs, because they were kind of getting big right before the movie came out, I was like, "Huh, all right, I'll see how this works." But yeah, it worked great.
Yeah,
yeah. I think you were talking about that earlier, like. Boogie Nights might be an example where there are moments where they're definitely listening to the music that's being played in the scene, and then there are moments where, you know, we're experiencing it. Yeah. Yeah, we're experiencing it, but they're not experiencing it on film.
I forgot how much music was in Boogie Nights until I watched it.
It's,
I guess,
like
last
American
year.
Graffiti, man. It's like every 2 minutes
they basically fade from one song right into the other. Do. Like, you're just like, all right, it's just like a long music video.
Yeah, that whole thing. Yeah. I mean, that one, the music.
Although
is
the firecracker scene, is it a Night Ranger song? Do you remember the firecracker scene where the kid's blowing up firecracker? They're on the by. Alfred Molina's got the robe on. It's all undone. He's all coked out of his head.
Oh, were they at his house? Or
yeah,
whatever?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
That seems amazing.
I feel like it was a Night Ranger song, but like Sister Christian or something like that, right?
But that seems amazing.
But that's a great example of doing that well, where it was a transition point in the film where they're like transitioning into the 80s.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And like hardcore. Sure. Like that song was a monster hit at the time. And then they put you in this just insane, you know, predicament with these guys on this quote unquote drug buy. But I thought that was a great example of, you know, how to use music in a scene along with the characters and
totally
keep everything moving forward.
Oh, what about Adaptation? That was...
Oh, yeah.
That was a good one. I also want to read you guys the top 25 soundtracks that Consequence of Sound has listed as the greatest movie soundtracks of all time.
Oh, we'll rough them up.
We'll just go blast through this list and see if you're in general consensus at all. So starting with 25, Blue Velvet.
Yeah. Okay. Sure.
Next up, Drive at 24.
I actually just watched it this weekend. Holds up.
Yeah,
I like soundtrack. Drive.
Yeah. 23, Pulp Fiction.
Okay. Yeah, obviously.
Heard of it. Easy Rider up next.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Clockwork Orange.
True.
I'm a fan of that movie, and I'm a fan of, like, Beethoven, but it kind of is. Kubrick does overuse simple classical music, and where it's really cool in 2001, I do get a little sick of it. And, okay.
And
that, but it's pretty.
I gotta go
music.
Back and watch Clockwork. It's been a long time since I've seen it.
Shield your eyes.
Yeah.
Baby Driver in at 20. Romeo and Juliet. There's another good one at 19. There's a lot of
does have candy
Radiohead.
Satin. Yeah.
Back to the Future at 18.
Yeah.
Friday at 17.
Okay.
Vanilla Sky. Look at that. At 16. Womp. Wow.
Womp. Yeah, you got a womp womp sound.
Ferris Bueller's Day Off at 15.
Oh, that's fun. That's
that
cute.
Should be like 25.
Yeah, that should have been higher on the list.
Rushmore at 14.
Rushmore's pretty
definitely
solid.
Sure.
Do the Right Thing at 13.
Ah, there you
go.
Okay. Now we're talking.
Singles at 12.
Singles.
I'm noticing that someone already did a better version of what we're trying to do. Go on.
This is fine. Shaft, 2001. Trainspotting, there's another good one.
Okay.
Harder They Come.
Brian Eno, when you're
Harder They Come,
into a toilet,
definitely.
Sure. Yeah, Harder They Come. Yeah. Above the Rim.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, that works. American Graffiti, and now our top five is a little predictable here. Dazed and Confused at 5.
Okay.
Yeah.
Superfly at 4.
Superfly's great.
Yeah.
I think that might be the best one for me.
Okay.
Bodyguard at 3.
What?
But it was one of the highest selling albums of all time.
Oh, no, for sure. Yeah. That single was just off.
That album has outsold like any Beatles combined. Just because that song.
That pause and then the drop, man.
I'm Every Woman is on this soundtrack as well.
Oh, is it really?
Damn. No.
Okay.
And then the top two here, The Graduate
and
Saturday Night Fever.
Just because
I wouldn't put them one and two.
See, me neither.
Fine.
Yeah.
I actually prefer, if we're doing, I prefer Harold and Maude's Cat Stevens over man. The yeah. Graduate.
Ooh, that didn't honest. Make the list either. That was, that's a good one.
Yeah.
That's a really good one.
All right. Should we take a nap and then come back and talk heroines?
Heroines, from heroin to heroines.
Let's do it.
Sounds good.
That was all Jason whistling. Let's give a hand to Jason for that great whistling.
I could listen to that all day.
Couldn't even stop to breathe.
He was breathing in for half of those whistles.
Yeah. Right.
Not watching the rest of this YouTube video.
That's the trick.
So Jason, you came across this Vulture article.
Yeah, I just thought maybe we'd take a little time. It's kind of talking about what's going on at Suns and Women's History Month and all this stuff, and I was just thinking over the weekend like about female heroines and kind of where they rank in space and time in the great spectrum of Hollywood, you know, cinematic history.
Yeah.
And so there was this article that came out last year, like August 2017, Vulture article, and it says the 11 most influential action heroines of our time, and we can kind of,
they can be argued, but it's a good list.
It's an okay list. I think it can definitely be argued, because I feel like that it's a total, it went from a list of top 10 to we have to add Wonder Woman and Gal Gadot in there somewhere, so they made it
I mean,
11 most influential, which if you go by box office,
clearly she will be one of the most influential.
Oh yeah, I think just on the size and scope of the film.
So let's summarize a very well summarized article in itself, but yeah, it does kind of follow how the genre of heroines in movies has been
marked
over time.
And there's like number 10 is Charlize Theron and Mad Max Fury Road, which I will tell you, when I went and saw that film and was totally excited, thought, this is going to be like Mad Max the max, and it's going to be like this very, picking up the mantle from where, the better Gibson films
off. And it left you thinking that Tom Hardy, cool actor, is kind of be driving the wheel of this thing, and he's going to be the titular character, Mad Max.
Right.
And it was a great shift away from that pretty quickly.
Yeah, the Furiosa just coming in and like dominating that movie pretty much start to finish.
Totally.
It becomes her film, and so she was listed at number 10, which, hard to argue with, and probably could argue should have been higher on the list. This is where it starts going awry for me a little bit, and feel free to... Well, it's like Angelina Jolie, and they listed her for two films, Tomb Raider, which, last time I checked was a pretty big flop, and Wanted, which last time I checked was also a pretty... I mean, maybe it made money, I don't know, but it was not a critical darling by any means.
I would say she kicks ass in Mr. and Mrs. Smith.
Yeah, right? I mean, I would think she's better in that.
No, I mean, she's...
in a better film, too.
I think that's maybe why they picked two movies, because she's undeniably a pretty cool character on and off screen. She's definitely like a cool, iconic kind of...
She's kind of a heroine in real life.
Yeah. She wears like crash shirts and all these cool punk outfits. Like,
right.
I'm into her.
No, I'm a total fan of Angelina Jolie. The next one, I was surprised to see it on the list. It's a film not a lot of people have seen, and an actress not a lot of people are aware of. It's Gina Carano in Haywire. If you haven't seen this film, it's Steven Soderbergh, 2011. and kind of on that run of where Soderbergh was just making whatever he wanted to make and self-producing and putting stuff out there. Yeah, and just like stuff was happening. But this one kind of slipped through the cracks a little bit, and it's well worth the time to watch it. The action scenes in this, it was one of the first ones I've seen with a female heroine who at the end of it has to deal with the results of like, oh, I just fought a 6'2", 210-pound man. I'm beat up. Despite the fact that I may have won this little battle, I am beat the heck up and have to deal with, you know, being alive moving forward in the film. And just the fact that it did that so well kind of gave it points for me. It's not a perfect film, but it's a lot of fun to watch, and it's Steven Soderbergh at the end of the day. But the actress Gina Carano is phenomenal in this. So that was number 8. Number 7, and we can talk about this a little bit, The Women of Kill Bill, Volumes 1 and 2.
Oh, yeah.
Some would argue maybe the one of the better collection of just female action in a movie over the period of about 4.5 hours.
I think I know what you're going to say, Ryan.
Well, should we hold on? Should we wait till we're done with this list, and we'll jump in with what the list is missing?
Oh, okay. Should we?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'll continue.
We'll come back.
We're going to hold back, but we've
got
words.
Number 6 is Michelle Rodriguez in the Fast and Furious franchise, all 27 of them.
This is a weird list.
It's a weird list, right? And then like number 5, and I've got comments on this at some point, but Mila Jovovich in The Fifth Element.
Should be clearly top 1 or 2.
Yeah.
But no mention of her in Resident Evil at all.
Which is a huge franchise.
Humongous franchise. Number 4, Scarlett Johansson in Captain America. Winter Soldier. I know, right?
Kind of pretty funny. Stuff. She's cool.
She's fine. She's, you know. Number 3, Pam Grier, Foxy Brown. Now we're getting back on track.
Okay.
Here we go.
Right? And I feel like number 2 and 1 people will tentatively agree with. But Linda Hamilton in Terminator, especially Terminator
so
2.
Great.
Judgment.
Okay. Yeah.
And then, of course, number 1 is hard to deny. Sigourney Weaver in Aliens as Ripley.
Okay, good.
Yeah. Right? I like that they specifically mentioned Aliens.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, the article, actually, we messed it up to make it worse than it is. It actually just starts off the gate with number 1 with Sigourney Weaver, which is kind of nice because you could just read the first 2 and then you can finish the article.
Right.
Tomb Raider, really, though. Like,
I know.
Of all the films ever made.
Yeah.
You know, I haven't watched it recently. Maybe it's got cool action.
Sure, maybe give it a chance.
It's probably not good.
Maybe not.
Well, okay, with Kill Bill, let's jump on that.
Yeah.
Obvious, David, you were breathing heavy. What's
I thought you were going to say it first, so that's why. Because I saw that you already made note of this. But Kill Bill is definitely an homage or a ripoff
of Lady Snowblood. Yeah. And Mako Kaji, she plays Lady Snowblood. I forget the character's name.
I think her name is Lady.
Lady. She plays Lady Snowblood, but she was also in like the Stray Cat movies and a couple of these like 70s Japanese kind of, I guess, in the style of exploitation comedy action movies.
Right.
But Lady Snowblood is an awesome samurai movie. It's beautifully shot.
Yeah.
Really cool choreography,
totally.
Cinematography,
colors. Yeah,
it's
music. She sings songs on it. Yeah,
and some of it. I mean, especially where were they?
If there's snow,
right. Well, that's what I was starting to say. I mean, the big battle between Uma Thurman and Lucy Liu.
Yeah,
I mean, it couldn't be more.
Yeah.
Like a direct pull from Lady Snowblood.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And then you're also, you think of the Vengeance trilogy is obviously, Lady Vengeance is clearly super influenced, I would say, by Lady Snowblood, just it being a vengeance tale and these badass characters. So I think the Vulture article, while it does like, cross
it
a few of the
T's. It redeems itself in the last 3 if you feel like the top 3 are pretty hard to argue.
Yeah,
I will say there's one glaring thing that I notice is like, I mean, if we're sort of bringing this back to Sons or the programming, there's only one movie in that list that's directed by a woman, I think.
Oh, really?
Which is Wonder Woman.
Oh, so they had to
which is at number 11.
I hadn't thought about that. That's interesting, yeah.
Well, this is where we... have short sides. Okay, so also, if anyone else wants to add to characters they think are missing, go for it. But if anyone's seen the movie Chocolate, Thai movie,
yeah.
It's
somewhat
so problematic with its portrayal of maybe autism or something similar. That being said, the character has experienced some trauma, which has made her socially unable to interact with people, and it seems like some manner of disability. So that isn't necessarily handled really well. However, because of this, she has like a photographic memory and can learn all of the martial arts from watching Bruce Lee movies.
Oh, yeah.
So throughout the movie, there's awesome choreography. It's just, she must have been like a teenager when she made this movie. And just killer choreography the whole time. And it will mimic stuff like, you know, Enter the Dragon or other martial arts movies. I think maybe she watched some Hong Kong cinema in it. And she whoops ass throughout the whole movie. So that one's way up on my list, despite... Don't watch it with the English dub. If you watch it with subtitles, it's really not as bad.
Yeah, that's. I've been over here trying not to lose it, laughing, because I remember we put it on. So you had the option of doing it with the subtitles.
Sure.
But there was some sort of confusion about if it was the right language with the subtitles. Anyways, we did the first half before intermission with like the dubbed version, and it was
English.
Real bad. And like people are just laughing at how bad it is, because it's like playing up on something that's already kind of problematic.
Yeah, like somewhat problematic portrayal. It's also somewhat of a budget movie, so they're not like great at handling the problematic. And in its own language, it's probably not as bad, but then the dubbing is so rough.
We're literally crying. It's so funny.
I can't remember the last time I watched something.
And then we switched it at intermission
dubbed.
to the subtitled version.
I think, speaking of people being teenagers and doing that, the one that I thought was pretty glaring on there, Saoirse Ronan as Hannah. The 2011 Joe Wright film.
Was it 11? Yeah. It was. That was great.
Yeah, it's 2011. And I mean, she's just literally a young teenage girl playing a young teenage girl and just slaughtering throughout that entire movie.
Wasn't her dad a spy or special forces or something into hiding, and she's been raised with like killer instinct and abilities her whole life?
Her entire upbringing was him out in the middle of nowhere, like in the Alaskan tundra, and you know, just like learning how to kill.
What about True Grit also?
Ooh,
yeah.
Speaking of young heroines,
she's great in that.
Which version, the 69 version or the... Or the Coen brothers.
I've never seen the 69 version.
Yeah, the Coen brothers version is better.
He's walked into a wall of pain, Jack. Tell him about the 69 version.
I would argue that, well, never mind. I don't know her name. The main actress in Girl Walks Home Alone at Night. Is it the director or no?
No, but I know exactly who you're talking about.
Well, while you're looking, I'm going to say Chris. Wait, you got it?
Sheila Vand?
Yep, Sheila Vand. I would argue that she's a heroine. Heroine?
Hero. She's a hero.
Theron.
Hero works.
There's a scene in that movie where I think she's very heroic, and when she actually scares the shit out of this kid at night who's kind of wandering around on his skateboard, and she's like, keeps asking him, she's like, "Are you a good boy?" You know, and he's like, "Yes." And she's like, "Are you lying to me?" And then she's like, "I will rip your eyes out of your skull." She's like, "I will always be watching you." And as I was watching it, I was like thinking, man, like imagine if like someone like Trump had that interaction, like, you know.
How much more grounded would we be if we got scared to death?
Yeah.
By David's dream girl, a vampire, a female vampire.
Yeah, we should probably talk more about your fascination.
Let's break this down. Okay, well, contrary to that, I'm going to say Buffy the Vampire Slayer, the movie version, Chrissy Swanson.
Ooh, very good.
Because I know people love the TV show, and I've come around, and I realized that I was wrong, and I should have watched it while it was on, but I just haven't seen that many, love the damn movie. It's so good.
Yeah. No, that's a good one. Chrissy Swanson, man.
G.I. Jane.
She had a moment, didn't she?
G.I. Jane.
Yeah.
Okay. G.I. Jane. Yeah. I mean, just...
Tank Girl.
I will say, like...
Tank Girl, definitely.
She physically Demi Moore in that movie is like insane.
Yeah.
The workout regimen she had to be on just to do that movie is beyond.
Wasn't she also in no Charlie's Stages Angels Fully Loaded?
She was. Or, yeah, no, she plays a she plays
the antagonist,
the villain. Yeah.
The Ooh. She also had a huge training regimen for that.
One yeah. more here, Barbarella.
Oh,
yeah. Barbarella. That counts, right?
Yeah.
I sure. think so. I was no, here I for think Halloween. Barbarella.
Were you really this year?
Last year.
All right. Barbarella. Nice.
Yeah.
yeah.
Just went for it.
My mom loved it.
This is where it would be better if we had visuals.
Yeah. yeah. If you want to see the visual, we'll be posting on the Line Hotel's blog.
on their homepage.
On their homepage.
Me wearing a pictures space of seductress. yeah. Just.
Should get a photo shoot of you in the one of the rooms as Barbarella.
I could just post the video I took of my legs getting waxed for the role. Ooh. Like day before Halloween, I was getting my legs waxed down in Mount Pleasant at I forget the name of the nail spa. I wish I could plug them right now.
How was that experience?
It sucked. It was so funny though. they kept on running out of wax. My legs were daunting for them.
I can't even imagine.
This might be a nice.
Good. Yeah, we're good.
Might be a good full circle ending here.
Yeah, I think we did it
with the theme song to Barbarella, which is also really good.
Yeah, it's so good.
Play us out, Jack.
Yeah, so you guys never had your legs waxed?
No,
never had my legs waxed. No.
Can you really?
It's on
be
my
a
bucket
feminist?
List. right.